Labor and Commerce now come to order. It's 3:33 p.m. on April 6th. With us, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, and myself, Chair Olson. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. We have four bills today. First one is House Bill 372, Omnibus Insurance. As members will recall, we heard this bill previously on March 28th and again on this past Monday, and we adopted the CS version H. Members have the an amendment in their packet. Can I have a motion to move the amendment?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Amendment H, number 1.
Okay, that was H.
Dot 1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Conrad will explain the amendment. And we've been joined by Representative Ledoux.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. In previous meetings, previous discussion of House Bill 372, there were concerns expressed regarding Section 11 on page 8. It had to do with the definition of emergency medical condition. The Amendment H.1 changes that definition to more closely mirror the ACA definition. One of the words that you will not find in the new amendment, which was mentioned a couple of times during testimony, was the word layperson. Part of the definition was they were talking about a prudent layperson. Layperson is not used in statute. After talking with Ledge Drafting, they said it was removed from the requested amendment. The amendment you have before you does the same thing. It's just to conform to the legislative drafting manual.
Representative Ledoux.
Is there anybody from Ledge Legal online that might explain if there is a difference between a reasonable person and a prudent person?
Let's find out.
Mr. Chairman, you should find Megan Wallace from Legislative Legal online.
And Megan is online. Megan, did you hear the question?
Good afternoon, Chair Olson. This is Megan Wallace from Legislative Legal. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to hear Representative Ledoux through her microphone. If you could repeat the question, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Ledoux?
Yes. Is there any difference between the reasonable person standard and the prudent person standard? Usually you hear the prudent person being used when it comes to investment decisions, whereas when it comes to whether or not a person has committed a wrong or kind of should know what they're doing if they're a lay person, that's usually the term I've heard used is the reasonable person standard. So I was just sort of wondering about that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I have not conducted any recent legal research to construe to see whether there's any case law construing the differences between a prudent person and a reasonable person. In this case, though, the prudent person is modified by a prudent person that possesses an average knowledge of health and medicine. And in this context, I don't think it's necessarily out of place, and I think it's just a matter of differentiating. You could use prudent person, and reasonable person is used in different contexts, and I would defer to the requester or the Division of Insurance, who might have more specialized knowledge as to which term that they prefer to use, but neither prudent person or reasonable person is defined in statute.
If I just follow up, and I actually see that after it says possesses an average knowledge of health and medicine could reasonably expect. But I just wanted some clarification, and maybe somebody from the Division of Insurance is on the line, or...
Unfortunately, the director is out of state temporarily. We do have Joe Thomas or... Oh, yeah, Mr. Hale. Come on up.
For the record, I'm Donald Hale of the Alaska Division of Insurance. Representative Ladeau, through the chair, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I believe it's a legal, it's really a question more for an attorney. I understand, as you do, what you're, when you were talking about a prudent person, it's also used to be referred to as a prudent man. Now it's referred as prudent person rule, but I'm not really sure that I can tell you that they are the same or that they are one in the same.
I think we have somebody looking it up right now as we speak.
No, I'm actually looking at something else. Sorry.
It's an interesting one. It's my intention to try to get the bill out today. Is this going to be something that worthy of slowing it down? Or
I'm not going to try to slow the bill down for this, but I'm wondering whether or not, as it goes through the stages that a bill needs to go through in order to pass, whether it could be followed up on.
I don't want to put words in Lori Wenghire's mouth since she isn't here, but I believe the intent of the change was also to keep it in conformance with ACA, which it does. And I think that's why it's in there, but I am not an attorney, so. And I don't want to be, by the way.
I just...
Representative Joseph.
Go ahead.
Oh, can I ask one question? The deputy director, is that right? Of the insurance division? No.
No, sir. I'm an insurance specialist with the Division of Insurance.
That might suffice, if I may. Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just curious about one thing. When we define emergency medical condition in Section 11, and my question is, I see that 2107 is entitled Patient Protections Under the Healthcare Insurance Policies, and I guess part of what we're trying to do is keep people out of emergency rooms unless they really need them. I mean, that's sort of the general mantra that is sort of widely appreciated. But when I look at these definitions, even including as written now, but also including the amended definition, the standard is high. You have to find that sort of internally in your own mind you could suffer serious dysfunction, impairment, or serious jeopardy. And when I relate that back to the chapter, Patient Protections Under Healthcare Insurance Policies, I'm just curious about what we're saying. Are we saying that that an insurance company could deny coverage at an emergency room unless it's plausible that the visitor or the patient was reasonably going to expect some of those types of egregious or serious conditions? Because so many people don't. And I think even if you ask them in the emergency room as they're sitting there, are you going to suffer a serious dysfunction of a bodily organ, they'd say, well, probably not. And if you went through this, they might leave and say, well, I don't meet this test. And so I'm just wondering where this definition gets applied. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And maybe a tough question. I don't
know. Through the chair, Representative Joseph, and yes, that is a bit of a tough question. It's my understanding that the purpose is someone with layman's knowledge or an average someone that's not a doctor, says, well, something's wrong. I hurt my ankle or something's wrong. I think I broke my ankle, and it's not broken. But they go to the doctor, or they go to the emergency room. And that may not be their best example, but I think I think the, you know, the purpose is to protect someone who goes to seek emergency care, and it's not what they thought it was. Does that make sense?
Yes. Can I clarify? You said it's not what they thought it was, or it could be precisely.
Or it could be precisely. Okay. Through the chair.
Thank you.
And again, I think there's enough safeguards built into it to where the emergency room would probably err on the side of caution, because I think some expensive things could happen to them if they didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think just a comment, though, and I think in the past I've seen situations where even medical professionals will recommend an emergency room visit for something that ends up not being an emergency, but in all abundance of caution, they want to make sure. So rather than try and wait overnight and have something more serious happen, they do recommend that individuals go to the emergency room. I would hope that language in here does protect those individuals who either believe themselves, even if it's not an emergency, that they are in danger, or are informed by other medical professionals that they should go to an emergency room. I just think it's very important to make sure that people aren't afraid to go to the emergency room because of something we might do here.
Does this bill have any other committees of referral?
No.
So its next stop is the floor? So again, Mr. Chairman, could we at least, without holding up the bill before it comes to the floor, I'd really like from the division some sort of a definition of reasonable versus prudent, because prudent sounds to me as somebody's got to be smarter than just reasonable. I mean, it sounds like it just sounds like a stricter standard.
Any thoughts, Megan?
Representative Olson, I heard Representative Ledoux's question, and I have been doing a little bit of investigating from my desk here, and it appears to me, and I haven't done, you know, I've only been researching since we've been on in the hearing, but I am seeing that a reasonably prudent person and a reasonable person have been used in similar contexts, and so from what I am looking at right now, I don't see that using the prudent person, especially in this context as it relates to a prudent person who possesses an average knowledge, that's any higher of a standard than reasonable person. And in some regards, I'm seeing that it's merely saying that, or the differentiation is minor as saying in terms of, if you think of it in a general negligence sense, is that things that a reasonable person wouldn't do and that a prudent person would do, or something that fine line of a distinction. So I don't think that it necessarily represents a different standard or a higher standard than a reasonable person standard.
Thank you.
Thanks, Megan. Thank you, Mr. Hale. Commissioner Parody, would you like to join us? I like the way you have that statute book open.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Parody. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I apologize for the unavailability of Director Wing Hire. She is en route in her return to the state after, I think, a business meeting and a family wedding. In prepping for this bill and discussing with her, my understanding was that this amendment was useful. And the section, the chapter that we're in, Chapter 7, of course, is patient protections under the health care insurance policies, and we are seeking here to bring our insurance statutes up to code with the current model acts, et cetera, under the Affordable Care Act. And this particular definition, I think the attorney online just clarified that a prudent person, as modified by the statement that they reasonably expect that they would place the person's health in serious jeopardy. what I would like to offer the committee is in line with Representative Ledoux's request that as soon as I can contact Director Winghire by email, I'll provide additional information to you. But I believe that the language is in order. I just need to confirm that and satisfy your question.
Thank you.
Yes, and I don't know if you can ask it. This is really, I think the definition, because it has the word average, is fine. I'm just wondering about the context of this, because I know there have been a lot of people that use the emergency department for non-emergency care. And I was wondering how this fits in the context of the statute. Are we saying the insurance company might not have to cover something if somebody goes for a bad cough when it could have waited to the next day, and doesn't fit the condition? I'm just wondering what the context of this is, just to help us understand why we're defining it.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Hughes, and again, I'd like to make contact with my director and get back to you, but I do believe the section we're in reading, and I was sitting at the chair trying to read it in context into the overall statute. There are the requirements for contract provisions for health care insurance that you have a utilization review process, and this is setting out the definition for how you can access that utilization review. So I do believe it's germane to that question. I do believe it's intended to be a patient protection by saying that if a reasonable person thinks that they need emergency room help, that's where they can go. But I need to confirm that understanding.
Yeah, I think that would be important. That's one of the reasons healthcare cost is as high as it is, because people use the emergency room for things they shouldn't use it for. And I was just wondering if there was an attempt here to perhaps not cover something when someone goes to the ER when it's a non-emergency medical condition. So that can be answered later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bring us into conformance with ACA. It's probably giving us things that patients didn't even know they had or even wanted. So I don't think they're trying to strip coverage out of it. I think there's probably more coverage in there than anybody really knows. But that's my personal opinion. Thank you. I can hold the bill over, or we can move it out and catch it before it goes to the floor. I mean, if there's something significant in it, we can fix it in rules.
I'm perfectly comfortable with doing that.
So I will lift my objection to the amendment. Is there any further objection to the amendment? H.1. Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. We closed out public testimony. We do have Deputy Commissioner Paradis and Don Hale in the room for any further questions. Any questions for anybody in the room? What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move CSHB 372 version 29-LS1379/H as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any opposition to this bill? Seeing none, the bill will move out of committee, and it will, after Representative Ledoux and you two, talk about the commissioner. We will take appropriate action, and with that, we'll take a brief adieu to sign the bill. Representative Culver. Next item on the agenda today is House Bill 372. Is that it? No.
234.
Oh. Yep. And we have a sponsor, Representative Vasquez, and I'm sorry, I'm out of order. And Anita from her office, I believe. Please state your name and affiliations for the record and tell us about the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is HB 234. I'm Representative Liz Vasquez. I represent District 22, West Anchorage. To my right is my Chief of Staff, Anita Holtman, and she will introduce the bill and speak to it.
Hello, Chair Olson and committee members. Again, thank you for hearing this bill.
Please read yourself out to the record.
My name's Anita Halterman, Chief of Staff for Rep. Vasquez. This is a pretty straightforward bill. House Bill 234 is a mental health parity bill. The bill primarily levels the playing field to require that the health insurance industry provide reimbursement for mental health coverage through the mode of delivery of telemedicine. Currently, Alaska Medicaid has been paying for telemedicine for mental health and substance abuse for many years. However, only one insurer in the state of Alaska has been providing reimbursement for mental health coverage via telemedicine. This bill would require that they provide that coverage via telemedicine without requiring a face-to-face visit. Approximately 15% of the population could be impacted by this bill and improve access to health care delivery for mental health services for Alaskans throughout Alaska. This bill does not provide new coverage. It just provides a new means of reimbursement for a coverage option that is currently available through the health insurance industry. I'd like to briefly talk about three issues that have come up in the process of working through this bill. The first issue that has been identified as an issue of concern by some writing in about the bill was a concern about the prohibition of a face-to-face encounter with this bill. And I would like to refer the committee to a document that has been presented for the hearing. That document is the American Telemedicine Association document from the National Conference of State Legislators that talks about the 50-state telemedicine gap analysis. And this document captures a landscape of all of the 50 states' status with regards to telemedicine. And it identifies that 22 states do have laws that give them the highest possible grade. Alaska receives an A-plus for our telemedicine for Medicaid reimbursement. However, unfortunately, we receive an F grade when it comes to the private sector. This bill is an effort to try to correct that issue. The most private insurers do cover reimbursement for telemedicine, but do not require a face-to-face encounter, and that is captured in that document that I just referenced. Texas and Arkansas appear to be the only states that do have a face-to-face requirement. However, Arizona is the only state that requires a face-to-face encounter before mental health services can be delivered for mental health. Texas has a face-to-face requirement, but not before telemedicine for mental health can begin. It's after the first encounter. If there's an ongoing relationship, they have a face-to-face requirement. So I'd like to point out that House Bill 234 does not prohibit a healthcare professional from requiring a face-to-face encounter. It leaves the decision up to the medical professional and takes it out of the hands of the insurer. It is important to preface that this is an insurance bill, not a medical bill. And so that distinction, I think, helps because, honestly, if a physician believes that it is in best practice to provide a face-to-face or make a face-to-face requirement for a patient, that face-to-face obligation is still within the hands of the medical professional, which is where it belongs. The second issue that was raised had asked for us to consider licensing within the state of Alaska, and I do want to clarify the bill does still require that a provider be licensed in this state in order to practice within Alaska. So this bill in no way changes that obligation. The third issue that has come up in comments about the bill is related to a request that we add substance abuse to the bill. And while they have caught our attention with that request, and we would like to consider it. What we've discovered is that the Alaska statutes that originally required that substance abuse be provided were repealed in 1997, and I've been getting some input from individuals within these industries about what definitions might be usable. We have not received full stakeholder buy-in, and we have made the very careful decision not to introduce a definition without allowing the folks that know this industry better than we do to weigh in and review the available definitions that are available nationally. We currently have no definition in Alaska state statute that we can easily turn to provide a clear definition of substance abuse. So in an effort to try to move this bill quickly, we've made a conscious decision to table the issue of substance abuse until we can have a more meaningful discussion and some consensus reached with those within the industry. And those are the only issues that have come up with regards to this particular piece of legislation. It's a simple, straightforward parity bill that requires the health insurance industry to do what Medicaid has been doing for many years.
I would like to compliment you on making a good call on that, because you'll probably be spending the first session of the next legislature getting through it, getting all the stakeholders aligned, and it will not be a simple bill like this one is.
Chair Olson, it does complicate matters, and we do want stakeholders to have input. Representative Vasquez just pointed out there are code of ethics, and we did introduce a document for the record for the medical professionals if they want to review codes of ethics that are available on a national level. There's some guidance documents they can look to help guide them with regards to face-to-face requirements and other issues that might affect this particular industry.
Anything to add, Representative Vasquez?
With regard to that issue, we do not want to attempt to micromanage the medical profession. It's up to them to figure out how they want to do that.
As somebody who's made that mistake on a couple of occasions, it's you made a good call.
Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Culver, followed by Representative Hughes.
Yeah, through the chair, you said there was some pushback on substance abuse telemedicine being covered by this legislation, and so you're not going to include it?
Representative Culver, through Chair Olson, indeed we have been asked to consider introducing a definition for substance abuse, but after consulting with Alaska's legislative research and individuals within the insurance industry, we've discovered there's a couple of different options, but there is no clean definition available currently in Alaska that we can turn to easily introduce a definition that already has been vetted by those that are stakeholders in this particular industry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that we don't opt out as a requirement or a possibility under this legislation, smoking cessation. That's generally handled over the phone. So depending on how you define what substance abuse is, and I guess I'm concerned that maybe somebody is just needing some counseling to what, where to go for those treatment services, just kind of get them in there. Like, you know, they realize that they maybe have a drinking issue or something, and they're not in a situation to have anybody to talk to help them get to the right place to go, if it's not on the phone, but it's in person. But the smoking cessation, I know, is quite actively done over the phone. So I want to make sure that we're not opting it out with if we do amend this down the road.
Representative Culver, through the chair, this is not an issue that came up, but what I will say in response to your question is my understanding, and having talked about the bill with individuals within the industry, is that typically ICD-10 codes are uniformly used primarily for substance abuse and mental health, and a lot of individuals have a comorbidity issue. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the services by default that are mental health in nature, even though they may directly be substance abuse related, indeed may be covered by this bill. In talking to the insurer Aetna, they've assured me by default much of what people are hoping to sweep in under a definition of substance abuse is already probably covered because of a uniform use of ICD-10 codes for behavioral health. And so some of this gets a little bit complicated, and we need to get some stakeholder input to determine what we need to do to ensure that whatever additional coverage might not be provided by this bill is considered for a potential piece of legislation for next session.
Okay.
Representative Hughes, followed by Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Representative Vasquez. And Anita, you've done a great job and definitely have done your homework, I can tell. The mental health care provider must be licensed in the state. Can the mental health care provider be out of state and be providing the telemedicine? Are we going to be able, is this going to mean we're going to have more access to more providers because they wouldn't have to reside or be in the state providing the telehealth? Are you calling telemedicine or telehealth? Whatever.
Telemedicine, I suppose. Representative Hughes through Chair Olson. I don't have the answer to that question, but we do have some folks on the line that might be able to answer that question. I'd like to defer it to those individuals, if I may. I believe Margaret Brody is on the line. She may.
Actually, what we're going to do is we're going to take the testimony from the one person that's in the room and then hold it over until Director Wangheyer can get together with the sponsor on a couple of things that are going to be tweaked. But
and can I have a follow-up with that, too? If that's information that you need to find out, I would like to know if that is the case. My understanding that it's often good with mental health to have a consistency of provider, and whether something like this can be is advised to have a person's mental health totally be by telemedicine, or whether it should be there should be some in person at some point. Because if the recommendation and is that there be some in person, then I'd be concerned if you have out of state people providing the service, because then I don't know how that would work. So just wondering about that. I think it is important to know whether we're opening it to out of state or not in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Culver.
Through the chair, on we've got an email dated January 16th from a J.D. Rauscher at Hope Counseling Center, John D. Rauscher, R-U-Y-T-E-R, and in his email to you, Representative Vasquez, second paragraph, it was in my packet here towards the end.
See, last page of the packet.
Okay. And anyway, second paragraph. Second to last sentence, he says, I'm very concerned that the bill's language specifically prohibits the requirement that face-to-face evaluation occur prior to telehealth services being reimbursed. This prohibition is a significant end run around best practices and safe delivery of mental health services using telehealth technology. Could you please address that issue? I'm sure it's not something that just came up. It's out there.
Representative Culver, through the chair, it's important to remember that this bill is an insurance bill. It is not a bill that influences the medical professionals. So this bill is this mandate of lacking a face-to-face requirement is a mandate on the insurance industry, not on the medical professionals. We in no way intend to change the best practices of the medical professionals. They have the right to require a face-to-face encounter. If they deem that is in their best interest with their practice, by all means, they may want to require a face-to-face requirement. This bill is just an imposition that the insurers not impose that face-to-face requirement, that decision be left to the medical professional.
Thank you. Follow? No, I think we got it covered.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I need to go to the HESC meeting.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Ms. Holtman can stay here.
Representative Kito. No more? Johnson.
Well, through the chair, I mean, most of this has been covered. I mean, my sense is that this is a good idea, except that, as others have said, that some face-to-face contact improves the efficacy of counseling. I mean, I just assume that's true. But in, through this bill, theoretically, someone could, for example, a Juneau citizen could decide to call someone in Anchorage rather than hiring someone in Juneau whom they would get to know face-to-face for a period of time? Is that correct?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, indeed, the bill does allow some flexibility for the medical professional. It will be up to that individual to determine whether or not it's appropriate to deliver mental health without a face-to-face requirement. The risk assumed for not requiring a face-to-face visit would rest with that medical professional, and if indeed their practice determines that that is not in the best interest, then by all means the medical professionals still have the right to establish practice rules that allow them to make a face-to-face requirement. It would be their liability if indeed they didn't require face-to-face. It's, again, important to remember this bill is not to influence the medical practice, but rather is trying to influence restrictions on the insurance industry that they not impose additional obligations. This bill is strictly restricting them from imposing a face-to-face requirement. It in no way restricts a medical professional from making a decision based on risk with their patients to require a face-to-face. Many practitioners may indeed do so despite this bill's lack of a face-to-face requirement for the industry.
Thank you. Would Skype be considered face-to-face contact? Or is that used in other states?
Chair Olson, I think if you look at the document, the 50-state document, indeed Skype might be an option. As I looked at what Texas, I believe, required, they have a face-to-face requirement, but they clearly don't define whether or not that can be done via video conferencing or if it's a physical face-to-face. Most state laws don't get so prescriptive as to define that. And so far to date, I've only found two states that have a face-to-face requirement. Those are Texas and Arizona. But they don't get down so detailed that they describe what that face-to-face obligation actually is.
And the reason I ask is I believe the telemedicine program has been operational in Kotzebue and around the North Slope uses Skype or something similar to Skype.
Chair Olson, Medicaid has been reimbursing for telemedicine since we introduced regulations in Alaska sometime between 1999 and 2005. While I was an analyst working for Medicaid, we actually wrote the first telemedicine regulations in the nation. We get an A-plus from the 50-state analysis because we are so open to allowing delivery of telemedicine in a variety of means. And we're really open to a number of venues for delivery. And there have been absolutely no reports of any concerns with Medicaid with regards to mental health or substance abuse delivered via telemedicine. The tribes, for instance, have a lot of exceptions. The Veterans Administration has exceptions. And Medicaid has been openly reimbursing. We heard from testimony from, comments from Margaret Brody, the Director of Healthcare Services, during our last hearing, that this bill actually will benefit Alaska Medicaid because right now Medicaid is picking up the tab for a lot of individuals who receive mental health through telemedicine because Medicaid reimburses it, but the private sector may not. And since they don't, they can't do a third-party recovery for those reimbursements. This bill would allow Medicaid to possibly recoup some monies from the private sector and have them pay some of the care that's delivered via telemedicine, where right now two of the insurers are not doing it at all. And one is doing it, but not in the way that this bill may prescribe.
I believe Medicaid picks up the air travel if needed as well, doesn't it? Which is a significant portion of it.
Quite a bit more expensive, Charles. And frankly, having to travel a patient in from a remote location to receive a face-to-face visit can be very costly in Alaska. And mental health has been delivered in at least 36 Medicaid states right now are reimbursing telemedicine and not reporting a ton of problems with the delivery mode.
Are there any further questions for Anita? If not, could you bring up, I'm going to open it up to public testimony briefly, and you have one person that came down from Anchorage, I believe, if you'd ask her to join us.
Dr. Evans.
Kim, sorry about
that. Getting
my apologies. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And,
my name is Dr. Aram Evans. I'm the medical director of Orion Behavioral Health Network. And Mr. Chair and committee, I really appreciate your opportunity to speak. I wanted to talk about how important this is for Alaska and our vulnerable population up here to move something like this forward. It's been a real challenge. Orion Behavioral Health does telemedicine throughout the state. Including we actually provide services to Kotzebue that you mentioned through the memorandum agreement with Manilis. And what's been happening over the last couple of years with third-party insurance administrators coming into the picture is that it used to be that the private insurances primarily paid for these services. In the last 3 years, they have cut that funding off, moving a lot of money from into the Medicaid system and reducing the care to a lot of people that are around the state. And so we've had multiple individuals who we used to take care of lose their insurance benefit when their insurance changed to a third-party administrator. And it puts a real strain on...
Unless you're in an ERISA plan and you have no choice.
Yeah. and so... So it's really, you know, we serve populations that just would not get care without telemedicine. We have homebound individuals that are autistic that are not able to leave their house for reasons. We serve communities where there's just no realistic way to have a psychiatrist on site. Without having the ability to use telemedicine, these people would be getting no care at all. And this bill is very nice in that it allows us to actually reach out to these individuals. You know, we're in situations where we have people that are double covered with private insurance, don't actually qualify for Medicaid. And so then the families are put in a situation where they have to decide, because they're in a community of 300 in you know, northwestern Alaska, do we pay for these services out of pocket? Do we not? And then what happens is these kids, and we primarily treat adolescents and developmentally delayed adults, these individuals get worse, and then they end up in our emergency rooms or in hospitals. They're flown thousands of miles away, or they have to foot the bill to fly into Anchorage, or Medicaid flies them into Anchorage. It's just a very, very difficult situation. You know, there were a couple of issues that were brought up as far as the face-to-face and out-of-state type providers, and I think I can speak to a little bit of that. I did actually personally speak to John DeRuyter after he wrote that email, and I clarified to him a couple of points. And one of the points is this bill really is talking about insurance, not talking about, you know, looking at changing the practice of licensing boards. The licensing boards have some fairly strict and sometimes difficult to navigate rules around how we're able to provide face-to-face services, particularly with Schedule II type medications versus a non-Schedule II type medication versus an interaction that doesn't involve medication. And so there currently are rules in place, and they are they are in a little bit of flux, but there are rules in place as to, you know, when is a face-to-face required, when is it required that you have a licensed professional on the other end of the telemedicine. There's certain circumstances if you have a RN on the other end that it will be acceptable. To a large degree, the medical board at this point is not really allowing out-of-state providers to practice telemedicine. In the state, there are certain circumstances in which you have an existing patient physician relationship, and then you can practice across state lines. But last legislative session, there was actually some legislation passed that kind of required not only to be licensed in the state, but actually to be in the state in order to practice in a lot of different ways. So it is important. Sometimes it's just not possible, and if you put that in very hard, where you cannot receive services unless you have a face-to-face, then you're effectively saying you will not receive services. We've got an aging population that's going to be increasingly homebound. We've got very rural communities that just are not able to get in for face-to-face services, and it'll just cut a lot of people out from services.
Who has the first question? Representative Hughes.
And I understand you're explaining the importance of access. This will allow people to have access that they wouldn't otherwise. I'm just wondering what best practices are for the standard of care if treatment would be considered good even without ever having a face-to-face, and in regard to, because I know there's been work. In fact, I thought there was something that allowed out-of-state, so I'm a little confused. For physicians, maybe we didn't pass the bill, but I remember there was one.
Well, I think Senate Bill 74, which is in the process of moving through, requires the medical board to adopt standards which will better allow or more clearly line out how out-of-state providers may be able to practice, but is not through yet.
Okay.
And so the current is that it is only in certain circumstances that it's allowed. But as far as the standard of care, you know, I think that the majority of the 50 states allow for care via telehealth without an in-person examination. I think when you look at the ethical guidelines for American Telemedicine Association, is not required. You know, in our practice, we always strive to do a face-to-face. In fact, I spent the morning here treating youth in Juneau here before coming to present to you. So we do a combination of flights. You know, we fly to Kotzebue, we fly to Juneau, we fly to Fairbanks to be able to provide that, you know, when possible. But there are certainly times where it's just flat not possible, and it is absolutely best care to give service to those individuals.
Thank you very much. Traveling down here, and I'm going to hold public testimony open, and we will take a brief at ease and set up for the next bill.
Thank you.
Today is Senate Bill 148. Deputy Commissioner Joe Thomas, or Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance, Joe Thomas, will be presenting the bill, and welcome back before the committee.
Yes, good afternoon. And for the record, I am Joe Thomas, Deputy Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development. Commissioner Dragas asked me to make her apologies for not being here today. She is at the Governor's Health and Safety Conference. Thank you, Chair Olson and members of the committee, for hearing SB 148 today. This legislation amends current workplace accident reporting requirements to include reporting of incidents that involve loss of an eye or an amputation. These amendments are necessary to keep pace with the federal workplace accident reporting standards that became effective January 1 of 2015. Alaska operates an approved state plan under the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, which requires that state maintain standards that at a minimum meet the federal standards. AS 1860030 also establishes that Alaska will maintain requirements that are at least as effective as those adopted by the U.S. Department of Labor. Federal OSHA made changes to the accident reporting requirements under Federal Regulation 29 CFR 1904 that took effect January 1 of 15, as I said. The changes require prompt reporting of industrial accidents resulting in an amputation or loss of an eye. Federal OSHA has notified the state that failure to maintain equivalency could jeopardize federal funding as well as the state's jurisdiction over occupational safety and health. We certainly want to maintain that jurisdiction. Most of the employers in the state of Alaska also are not enthused about more federal oversight. And we're also interested in maintaining the funding that comes along with that jurisdiction. SB 148 simply brings Alaska's workplace accident reporting standards up to the federal standards, and I would urge your support of SB 148. I'm available to answer any questions you might have. And also standing by phone is Gray Mitchell, Division Director of Labor Standards and Safety.
Who's got the first question? Representative Hughes.
I'm just wondering what the definition of amputation, I think of arms and legs. I'm just wondering if it includes, digits, if it includes like an ear or another body part, because we're talking about an eye. And then amputation, so I'm just wondering if amputation covers anything else that...
Through the chair, Vice Chair Hughes, I believe amputation is, as you're describing it, is any loss of limb, digit, whatever it might be, and that that's my understanding anyhow. Any loss.
I knew that'd get a bite out of Representative Ledoux.
No, actually, it's a different question.
Oh, okay.
So, the notice requirement on the part of the employer,
mm-hmm.
What level is that? I mean, presumably, somebody's on a work crew and is killed or has an amputation mm-hmm. or something like that. Somebody from the company knows about it.
Correct.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out at what point does that notice become notice of the employers for this to kick in. For example, the subsection does not apply to an employer that first receives information of a fatality or inpatient loss, et cetera, more than 30 days after the accident. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a heck of a long time
that
for an employer not to know that one of his people has gotten killed. Obviously, somebody in the company knew it.
One would think so. That's correct. And obviously, it can be anyone that is in the employ of the employer as well. It could be a general foreman, a superintendent, another a co-employee or whatever, making that notice to the Department of Labor is what it amounts to.
But follow up.
Through the chair.
So is it an excuse if it's not reported that the president of the company says, well, nobody told me, if the job foreman knew about it?
Through the chair, it would be my assumption that as long as there were people aware on the job that it took place, that it would be expected that the employer should know, particularly depending on the severity of the situation.
New question?
Yes. Well, it's kind of a follow-up for the same general. So what circumstances can you imagine that an employer wouldn't know about it, particularly when we're talking about not knowing about it for 30 days? Give me an example here, okay?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the only ones that I can think of is if an employer is the owner of the company or something is on vacation and is in some place where he's not able to be contacted by the superintendent or something like that.
New question?
But wouldn't the superintendent, wouldn't somebody from the company be obligated to report it? I mean, the fact that the owner is on vacation and hasn't bothered to leave, a telephone number with somebody.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think that's why the term employer is used, not necessarily owner. It indicates that anybody that is on the job can actually report the incident. And that's generally what happens. The owner of the company is made aware, I'm sure, in some period of time by the superintendent, but generally they're going to call the ambulance and they're going to call the Department of Labor and inform them that they've had a workplace accident and this is the nature of it.
So what happens if the supervisor doesn't report it?
Well, then I guess, through the chair, then I would suspect that the letter of the law is what it is, that they would be holding the employer responsible for not reporting.
Actually, we're leaving somebody out of the loop because of the severity. I mean, if you're losing an arm or a leg or an eye or an ear, the hospital is going to be calling the employer and the insurance company to confirm, number one, that he is an employee, and number two, that he there is workers' compensation insurance on the people. So I don't think it's going to go 30 days because of the severity. I think it's going to go by 3 hours.
So, but my question is, and it really doesn't just relate to this new amendment of it. I mean, why is there this out that it doesn't reply if they first get notice within 30 days after the accident? And I'm still not hearing where somebody could lose an arm or a leg or an eye or be killed and that nobody would know about it for 30 days.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I agree. I don't think that would ever be the situation, quite honestly. And the language is based on federal language. So, you know, in compliance with them, we use oftentimes their wording.
Thank you.
That's the best explanation I can give for that part of it.
Representative Hughes.
The word employer is, let's say the owner is on vacation for 6 months without a cell phone. Does the word employer, would it cover then the superintendent or somebody on down from the owner, or does the word employer just mean the owner, the top
through the
person?
Chair, Vice Chair Hughes, yes, that's how we interpret it.
That follow-up?
Oh.
That it would include anyone at the company or the next person down the list from the top?
Through the Chair, Vice Chair Hughes, yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was speculating, it's probably whoever answers the phone. Was this person an employee? Representative Ledoux?
I actually thought of a situation where the employer might not know about it, actually.
Remote site?
Remote site.
Any further questions? Representative Colbert.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Mr. Thomas, what are the statistics for these kind of trauma in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative McCulver, I can't give you verbatim a variety of the accidents to this degree. We've had just this calendar year there have been 3 fatalities, and other than that, as far as amputations, I couldn't give you a number, but we could certainly gather that information and get it back to you.
Paul?
Paul?
So I remember we had a trench incident in Anchorage. I think that was last summer. And then you say already in 2016 we've had 3 fatalities?
Through the chair, Representative Colbert. I was talking about last calendar year. I guess I didn't clarify that. That's including the fatality you're talking about.
Right.
And 2 others.
What were those other?
One was the accident, through the chair, the accident at CMI's shop in Anchorage, and the fatality, the death of a healthcare worker in a long-term care home.
Okay. Well, so was the CMI, was it an overhead crane issue or something like that? I don't recall that one.
Through the chair, Representative Culver, it was a loader that was being worked on, and the jack failed to hold the arm in place. They had taken the bucket off it, but the arm was raised and set on a jack stand so that they could remove and repair hydraulic lines, and the jack failed and crushed.
Well, sorry to hear that. Thank you.
Any further questions? But with that, I think I will open up public testimony. I might add that we do have Gray Mitchell from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development online for questions if anybody has any for Gray. But is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Hearing none, we will close out public testimony. Bring it back to the committee for discussion. What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move SB 148 version 29-GS2801/W from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee, and we'll take a brief at ease for signing the paperwork. And thanks for bringing us a simple bill, Joe. The calendar today is House Bill 142. Senate bill, I'm sorry. Let's see. Carrie Noor, are you with us? Carrie will be presenting the bill on behalf of Senator Giesel, who was tied up in another committee. Members have a proposed amendment in their packet. Can I have a motion to adopt the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move amendment W.A.1.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Carrie, you want to walk us through the bill and the amendment?
Of course, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Noor, staff to Senator Giesel. So the amendment before you changes the effective date of the bill. This was brought at the request of Primera in order for them to ensure that they can completely implement this change and not affect any sort of premiums or any additional cost. So that is why the amendment is before you today.
So I believe this is the first time we've heard the bill, isn't it?
Conrad?
Yes.
So, might as well start at the top.
Of course.
Oh, is there any objection to, I'll remove my objection. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment?
No. I want to discuss it if I could.
Well, certainly.
So, I mean, to a certain extent, this bill looks pretty important because I know that there are certain times that somebody gets some cancer medication which is paid for and then they get it in another form and it's not paid for. And so, I mean, cancer doesn't wait 6 months necessarily. And so making that effective date as of the 17th, I mean, what about all the people who need the help now? I'd rather make it effective, like, immediately.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, Primera came to us, and their concern is, so for their filings for FY 2016, they have to submit those by May 6th of this year, and there's concern that if this bill were to be passed, that this would happen after they've already submitted their filings, which would have to cause them to go back and amend them and cause fiscal impact that we would like to prevent from being passed on to consumers. That's why it's January 1st, 2017.
And additionally, all the contracts come up on January 1st, so there are already contracts in place that are good till the 12/31.
And Mr.
So
Chair.
So it would be a paperwork
and
disaster.
Might I add, Mr. Chair, that this would only apply to new plans and renewed plans, so it would not affect plans currently in place.
Follow.
So, session presumably gets over on April 17th or 18th. So, I guess it would seem like if we were to pass this bill with giving it an effective date prior to May 6th, I mean, wouldn't that give them like about 3 weeks to get their act together with respect to the filing?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I just wanted to ensure that all our bases were covered, so that way we wouldn't be putting any additional burden on consumers, especially as this only applies to renewed plans and they're already going through that process.
Thank you.
I think I can help you on that, too. The bill won't be moving today. I mean, it's going to take us up until 5 o'clock probably just to get through it. And we do have Larry Wanghier on our way back, and we are going to be under the 24-hour rule starting tomorrow. I don't anticipate using it on a 24-hour basis, probably 48 hours notice. But we can move fast on it, and I think, again, when Larry is back here, we can address all the issues in a few hours to make you feel more comfortable with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And it's not an unreasonable request. I wondered about that as well. But you want to start on the bill?
Of course, Mr. Chair. So Senate Bill 142 that is before you today, it seeks to modernize the current system when it comes to cancer treatments. This bill ensures that both intravenously and orally administered cancer treatments are treated fairly and are equally available to consumers. So currently, how it works is there is a disparity between what patients pay for intravenous cancer treatments versus oral cancer treatments. And this is due to the fact that oftentimes the oral cancer treatments are billed as prescriptions, which there's usually no deductible that is met, which prevents consumers from continuing to pay, whereas intravenous cancer treatments are often billed as medical benefits, which you almost always have a deductible that you reach and no longer pay. So when oral cancer treatment is much, much cheaper for administration costs, et cetera, it ends up being more expensive, which is very counterintuitive. And also, certain cancer treatments are only available in the oral option, and therefore patients should not be forced to pay higher premiums simply because their treatment is only available in the oral form. This bill also prevents the reclassification of benefits or increasing costs with respect to both intravenous and oral cancer treatments. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Hughes, I'm guessing.
So I'm sort of wondering why it's just limited to cancer treatments. Something that's driven me crazy over the past couple of years is I do a lot of traveling, and sometimes I travel to relatively remote places. So I like to get typhoid inoculations. But you can get typhoid inoculations in two ways. You can get either a shot, which hurts, or you can get oral pills, which don't hurt. And if you take it through the shot, it's covered by your insurance. But if you take it orally, I've never been able to get reimbursed by anybody. So why is it just limited to cancer medications? I bet there's all sorts of drugs which can be taken both orally or by shot.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I am not familiar. We've just chosen to focus on the anti-cancer medications as it stands. So that could be potentially something that the director of the Division of Insurance may be able to answer a little bit better, and could be potentially a separate piece of legislation that can be looked at further on later.
Thank you.
Any further questions? We do have several people lined up to testify, so if there are no further questions, you're going to stick around, I assume. We will open it up to public testimony. Emily, please join us. Welcome back. Seems like we were just here a couple days ago.
Well, Chairman Olson, for the record, I'm Emily Neenan. I am the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. Thank you for your time. I do recognize that all the days are blending together now. We are excited that this legislation is moving forward. One thing that Kari didn't mention is that 40 states have already adopted this measure. This is really a modernization of our state's insurance statutes because of the tremendous changes in cancer research that so many more options are available in an oral form as opposed to infusion. As Kari mentioned, this isn't just about whether a physician prescribes your chemo in the pill or in the infusion. There are some chemo treatments that are only available in the pill form, in the oral form. So something to keep in mind. Right now, about 25% of the new treatments in the research pipeline for cancer are oral treatments. So it's only going to increase this issue. Also want to point out that the oral medications often have fewer side effects. And the ease of administration is a huge issue, particularly in our geographic challenges that we have in our state. So a great option for patients. We are excited to see this moving forward, and again, just modernization of our statutes. Thank you.
Any questions for Emily? Thanks again for joining us. Let's see. We also have Eric Hansen in the room, I believe. Welcome, Mr. Hansen, and please state your name and affiliation for the record. And thank you for sticking out the whole meeting.
No problem. My name's Eric Hansen. I'm from Juno. The International Myeloma Foundation asked me to come by today. I'm a patient and an advocate also for patients. And I got cancer 4 years ago. It's called multiple myeloma, caused by exposure to Agent Orange, but it's incurable and it's treatable by drugs, chemo. And biotech, as was mentioned, has done some tremendous things just since I was diagnosed. And it's made the insurance template kind of obsolete. The old pharmacy benefit for blood pressure pills or whatever you might need, it doesn't cut it with cancer. And so what the issue, I think, for most patients isn't so much the needles and the toxicity of chemo and all the rest of that stuff. It's access, especially up here. In Juneau, for example, there's only one nurse that can handle chemo. It's a highly specialized, it's got a lot of liability attached to it and so on. So there's very few places in the whole state where you can actually get your chemo. And, I don't know what people in Kenai, Cordova, North Pole, you know, Haines, Petersburg people I know have to come up here for their chemo, however often they need it, and it's frequently every week, or twice a week in some cases. It's real hard to do. With the pills that are available sometimes, as was mentioned, these pills are targeted toward cancer. Chemo fluids just kill everything.
Yeah.
And that causes lots of problems. So anytime, for all these reasons, that we can get a pill without the huge co-pays, it's a godsend. Patients have to meet the hospital schedule rather than their own life. If the nurse gets sick, goes on leave, and you wait, not very often. It takes a half a day just to get your chemo by infusion. And so the other thing that can happen with all the blood tests that you have to take, even to qualify for these injections every week, and the needles that go in your veins and so on, your veins can collapse. Mm-hmm. Mine finally did after 2 years, and so then you can't do that very well. And then you need a surgical procedure that puts a port in your chest so they can access your vein that way. But I've been administering my own chemo for 3 years. Right there. Before breakfast every day, and that does it.
One pill.
It's called Revlimid, sir. Revlimid.
Oh, okay, but I mean just one pill a day.
One pill a day.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. And they'll wear out. This cancer learns how to beat these things eventually. So when it does, then I've got possible options of a combination of three pills for as long as they last. But in the meantime, eventually I'm going to go to chemo again on infusions, probably, unless biotech does some more amazing things, which they very well might. So, you know, it's been incredible. I've had to think about the fact that I may have to leave home and go somewhere else if the chemo department here in Juneau folds, or if there are interruptions in it, and people in outside the city or outside Anchorage, their immediate problem is, well, do they sell out? Do they move out of state in some cases, or Anchorage at least? Huge decisions that, you know, that have to be faced, especially if this insurance glitch doesn't get resolved by your bill, which is an excellent bill. I never saw a one-page bill that did so much. I really urge that you pass it, because every cancer patient has the same issues. We immediately get chemo, we immediately get infusions. Hopefully they can change us over to a pill, but the road is the same. And this bill takes one huge problem off the table.
I appreciate you taking the time to come in and testify, and we're going to be moving as fast as we can on it. And it's already come out of the Senate, so I think this is the last stop before it hits the floor. But Representative Ledoux.
So what's your view as far as you're concerned and your insurance with changing the effective date from immediately to January?
Well, as a patient, I would say make this happen tomorrow. I mean, there's somebody out there probably that can't afford the copay, and he's going to have to go somewhere to get treatment, and then he goes through all the decision-making process. What the issue is with the insurance companies to get the paperwork lined up, I don't know. But certainly the sooner the better for a patient.
Thank you.
Representative Colbert.
Thank you for coming. I think that's the most compelling testimony I think I've heard since I've been here. And we get it. If you don't mind asking, what is it costing you to copay for these oral medications that you need to save your life?
Well, I'm lucky because I got old enough before it hit to be on Medicare, and that covers me. But a few years ago, when I was still working and had my own little business, if this had hit me then, my copay would have been $2,000 a month. Mm-hmm. Every month. Year after year, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I would have had to tell the oncologist, "I'm sorry, I'd love that, but I got to stop and go back to the fluids, go back to the hospital, the clinic, whatever." Pills, $10,000 a month, and I think all cancer pills, medicines, fluids, chemo, all of it probably is about the same, because they're all unique now and targeted.
My prayers are with you for healing. Thanks for coming out.
You bet.
Any further questions? Thanks again.
Thank you.
Kimberly Thias, are you with us?
I am. Thank you so much.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My name is Kimberly Tice, and I'm the advocacy manager for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And I want to echo all the sentiments that have been shared in regards to this bill, but would say that we believe that this is a very vital solution intended to ensure that patients can reliably and consistently expect fair coverage for cancer treatment, even when those treatments happen to come in the form of a pill, like you've just heard. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is hopeful that the lawmakers in Alaska will embrace this bill, and because it helps to offer meaningful improvements in access to care. So I'm available for any questions.
Any questions? Thanks again. And with that, we will hold public testimony open and hold the bill over and get it out here as fast as we can. And with that, we'll adjourn at 5 minutes to 5:00.